Welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting programs from the golden age of radio. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Later on, I'll be bringing you a montage of news coverage from the day Pearl Harbor was attacked in 1941. But first, to lead off the hour, it's the These Are Our Men series, produced at the tail end of World War II as part of the War Loan Drive designed to raise funds for the effort overseas during the Second World War. The series brought forth biographies of those instrumental into our success in the war, from generals to lieutenants, and in this first broadcast, a tribute to Franklin Delano Roosevelt with Frank Sinatra. This first heard on December 2nd, 1944.
These are our men. The Parker Watch Company dedicates this program to the United States Treasury Department for the sale of war bonds. With Frank Sinatra as our special guest today, we proudly present this new series of dramatic programs. These are our men. Total victory, these are our men. Marshall, King, Vandegrift, Eisenhower, Nimitz, MacArthur, Arnold, Wainwright, Halsey, Clark, Patton, Somerville. Yes, these are our men, the men in whom 136 million Americans have placed the nation's trust, but about whom most of us know little or nothing. What do you know about Eisenhower? What sort of a man is bushy-browed Halsey? Are all those legends about MacArthur true? Who's known as the greatest strategist in the United States Navy? You'll learn the answers to all these questions and many more each week on this new series of programs presented by the Parker Watch Company. We're going to present the authentic life stories, the dramatic profiles of these men of ours who lead us to victory. Today we give you our Commander-in-Chief, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. President Roosevelt's story in just a minute with Mr. William Adams, the distinguished American actor impersonating Mr. Roosevelt. But first, well, how about a word from our guest, the boy who has sung his way into millions of hearts? And here he is, Frank Sinatra. Well, I guess I should start out by being formal, Frank, and say, on behalf of the United States Treasury Department, I want to thank you for joining us this afternoon as special bond salesman.
Thank you, Jack, and I'd like to say on behalf of the United States Treasury Department, I'm very happy to be here.
By the way, we're very proud of the fact that our sponsor is buying time for an outstanding series on a nationwide network and paying all the costs of the programs without a commercial announcement for their money.
Jack, just a second. There will be commercials on this year's show.
My gosh, you're right, Frank. We're here to sell war bonds, and we expect to hear from you on that score.
Don't worry about a thing, Jackson. You sure will. But let's get on with the show, and I'll be back later.
Right you are, Frank Sinatra. And now, episode number one of These Are Our Men, the life story of our Commander-in-Chief, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. This is the story of a poor little rich boy who refused to have life handed to him on a silver platter. A poor little rich boy who worked and achieved greatness the hard way. This is the story of a burning ambition and a refusal to admit that any opposition was too big. The story of a shining career halted four times by illness, but never stopped. This is the story of Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
New York and Pennsylvania.
Yes, November 7th, 1944, a typical American election night with wild, excited crowds swarming in New York's Times Square, Chicago's Loop, and around the town hall in Tompkins Corners. One of the hottest elections in the nation's history was on its way to a decision, a precedent-smashing decision. Finally, it came.
Ladies and gentlemen, beyond any doubt, it's Roosevelt for a fourth term.
the first time in our history, we Americans sent a man back to the White House for his fourth term of office, thus serving notice on our enemies that when the welfare of our country is at stake, we are willing to sacrifice any tradition or smash any precedent. We all remember the first Roosevelt inauguration back in 1932, but even that was by no means Franklin Roosevelt's first visit to the White House. Let's go back to the White House study of Grover Cleveland. In the year 1887.
Oh, come in, come in. I'm glad to see you.
I know how busy you are, Mr. President. Good of you to see me.
Why shouldn't I, James? After the way you worked for my election as governor of New York? And you helped make me president, too. Now, who's the young sailor you've got with you?
Mr. Cleveland, I want you to meet my son, Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
How do you do, Mr. Cleveland?
Well, how do you do, young man?
He's quite a big man to be only five, eh, Mr. President?
Only five? Mm-hmm. Why, I was about to offer him a cigar. All dressed up in a sailor suit. I suppose when you grow up, young man, you want to be president too, huh?
Oh, no, sir. I want to be a sailor.
Well, you've got a mighty smart son there, James. I've had 2 years of this job, and I know it isn't easy.
The country thinks you're doing a good job, Mr. President.
I do my best, James, but... Well, young man... I want to make a wish for you.
Yes, sir?
My wish is this, that you may always have health and happiness, and that you may never become president of the United States.
In 1893, at the age of 11, Franklin Roosevelt had his first experience in action with the ideal which men and nations have come to know as liberty. It was in the office of the Imperial Guard in the fortified city of Strasbourg, Germany. Just after dark, the lieutenant of the guard was amusing himself with a music box.
Herr Leutnant.
Ja, Corporal, what is it?
I have with me two prisoners.
Prisoners, eh? Then the officer of the guard should not receive them while playing a music box. There. Who did you say? Bring them in.
Ja, Herr Leutnant. Prisoners!
Yes, I see. One is rather small, isn't he? Man, what's your name?
Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Age?
11, going on 12.
Nationality?
The United States of America. This is my tutor with me.
Oh. Well, I see the papers are in order, Corporal. Charge?
Charge? Placed under arrest for trying to enter His Imperial Germanic Majesty's fortified city of Strasbourg and with or in a wheeled vehicle after dark.
We were on bicycles, sir, and it was your guard's fault we're so late. If they hadn't arrested us so many times today, we'd have been here before dark.
So you arrested more than once today?
The first time was when the goose ran in front of my bike.
Yeah?
Arrested and fined 5 marks. Then there were the cherries.
Cherries?
Oh, they were growing beside the road. Not inside a field, but hanging over the fence. Arrested again. Then we took our bikes through the waiting room at the station.
Illegal, that. Yes, illegal.
But that was the only way to get to the train. The soldiers got us, though. All that made us so late trying to get back to our hotel.
That you arrested again trying to enter Strasbourg after dark.
In the United States, we don't arrest people every time they turn around.
That will do, if you please. Corporal Lantz.
To be fair.
You are to be congratulated on your proficiency in protecting the Empire. You may go.
Ja, Herr Leutnant.
Well, if the fine's too much, I can't pay it, and that's that. I've already spent most of my allowance on fines.
Master Roosevelt, here in Germany, we do not do as we wish. In this country, we do as we are told.
And that was Roosevelt's first lesson in the German way of doing things. He liked the American way best. Then, in the tradition of many American boys, he wanted to run away and go to sea. Later, he wanted to go to the Naval Academy, but his father talked him out of the notion. At 16, he was a student at Groton. When, in the year 1898. Remember the Maine, a glorious call to a boy's heart, that slogan. A call that Franklin Roosevelt couldn't ignore. Parental consent was out of the question, and so young Roosevelt, with some of the other fellows, made deep-laid plans to run away and help fight the Spanish-American War. The plans were perfect, but just at the last moment.
What's your name, young man?
Roosevelt, Doctor. Franklin Roosevelt. What is it, sir?
Measles, young fellow. Measles.
A case of measles may have changed the entire course of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's life, for it stopped this attempt to become a part of the United States Navy. He remained at Groton and then went on to Harvard. There he became managing editor of the Harvard Crimson, and his editorials perhaps offer some clue to his later career.
Hey, Bud, you seen Frank Roosevelt's latest piece in the Crimson?
No, what's Frank up to this time?
Remember how he told the college officials the buildings were fire traps, right to their teeth, he told them?
And he got action, didn't he? They put in fire escape.
Yeah, but this time it's serious. Listen to this. I'll read it. It is time the entire student body took an interest in the election of class officers. Too long, these elections have been controlled by one fraternity, by a few students who are wealthy aristocrats. Officers should be elected on the basis of ability, not because of background or present circumstances. There you are.
What does he mean, wealthy aristocrats? He's one of us himself, isn't he?
You know how Frank is. Always going around sticking out his jaw in favor of the underdog.
But toward the end of his last year at Harvard, Frank Roosevelt sometimes seemed lost in thought, absent-minded. There was a reason. Her name was Anna Eleanor Roosevelt, his sixth cousin. On St. Patrick's Day, 1905, they were married. The bride was given away by her uncle, President Teddy Roosevelt himself. After his marriage, the groom continued his postgraduate studies at Columbia University. 5 years later, not yet 29, Roosevelt made his entry into politics as a result of a meeting in the town of Poughkeepsie.
Well, gents, if that's all the business, I think we've got a good slate of candidates for this section of state.
Jack.
Oh, Mayor Segg, you've got something to say?
Here's to me. There's one candidate we've neglected to name. So far, there's been no mention of a Democratic candidate for state senator from the counties of Dutchess, Putnam, and Columbia.
Why name one? Only one Democrat's been elected from there in more than 50 years.
That's right. Yes, Mayor Segg, there's no money in the Treasury for a useless campaign.
So it happens, gents, I've taken care of that. I've got a candidate who can pay his own freight.
Yeah?
It's young Frank Roosevelt.
Will he make the race?
I've convinced him that he should. His mother was against it. Said it was too undignified for Roosevelt. Would interfere with his career. Yeah. I convinced her by telling her Frank didn't have a chance to win.
Well, then I don't see why he'd go to the bother of it.
Well, young Roosevelt's funny. Apparently doesn't know much about politics. He's got the idea he might be elected. And we'll be able to do the people some good.
Who does Frank Roosevelt think he is? Been in the state senate 1 week, and he thinks he's big enough to whip Boss Murphy of Tammany.
Murphy's made up his mind he'll send blue-eyed Billy Sheehan to the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, but unless Frank Roosevelt and his little group vote for him, Boss Murphy's whipped.
That's right. And Frank says blue-eyed Billy is a little too close to the New York Traction Trust to suit him.
If Frank doesn't expect to have much of a political career, starts out by bucking the Traction Boys in Tammany Hall.
It's a lot worse than that. His story about Roosevelt's in the papers all over the country.
Yes, I know.
It's raising such a smell that state legislatures might lose the right to elect U.S. senators.
Sure. Why, if this thing goes far enough, might get to where U.S. senators are elected by the people.
Well, blue-eyed Billy Sheehan of Buffalo did not go to the United States Senate, and the name of Franklin Roosevelt became one to reckon with. Then, in the spring of 1913, as he planned his campaign for re-election, he was stricken with typhoid. But with his good friend, Louis McHenry Howe, managing his campaign, Roosevelt was re-elected to the New York State Senate from his sickbed, and thus began one of the warmest, firmest friendships in modern politics, Howe and Roosevelt. On March 1st, 1913, Roosevelt was in Washington for the inauguration of Woodrow Wilson. He was offered the job of collector of the Port of New York. He refused it. He was offered the job of assistant secretary of the Treasury. He refused it. Later that same day, he ran into Josephus Daniels, who offered him the one job in the government he wanted. He took it like a shot. At 31, he became assistant secretary of the Navy. The next year... World War. As Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Franklin Roosevelt worked night and day that the United States Navy might be ready. In fact, he worked almost too well, for in 1917, about 10 days after the United States entered the war,
he got a hurry call from the White House. Usher Ike Hoover took him straight to President Wilson's office.
Yes, Mr. President, you sent for me.
Oh, yes, Mr. Roosevelt.
This is General Hugh Scott, Chief of Staff of the Army. General, Mr. Roosevelt.
Yes, I know.
Yes, I've met the General.
Now, Mr. Roosevelt, there's something I want to talk about.
Yes, Mr. President.
About the way you've been buying supplies for the Navy.
Well, I admit I've cut red tape in a few cases,
That's
but...
not the point. It's not how you've been getting supplies. It's the amount.
But this is war, Mr. President. I want the Navy to have everything it needs to do its job. The men of our Navy deserve that, and...
I know, I know. I see I may as well commend you. You've done a wonderful job.
Thank you.
Fact is, however, Mr. Roosevelt, we've also got an army in this country. That's what General Scott is here to see me about.
Oh.
You've been buying up supplies so fast that in a great many cases you've bought up all there are.
No.
Yes? I'm sorry, Mr. Roosevelt, but the Navy will have to give up some of its supplies to the Army.
In June of 1918, Roosevelt was offered the Democratic nomination for the governorship of New York. He refused, suggesting another candidate, Alfred E. Smith. In July, he went abroad to inspect the battle zones. In England, he met the leaders of the day with one exception. He did not happen to run into the young man who was being blamed for the awful defeat at Gallipoli, Winston Churchill. In France, he met Clemenceau, Poincaré, and Marshal Foch. He toured the actual fighting areas at Belleau Wood, at Chateau Thierry, at Nancy. And when he boarded the Leviathan to come home, he had decided to resign and don the uniform of a fighting officer in the United States Navy. This was not to be.
Well, how are you feeling this morning, Mr. Roosevelt?
Very well. Fine, Doctor. How many days out are we?
Only two. You've been, well, asleep most of the time.
There was a lot of flu in breast, I remember. Must have picked up a touch of it.
It's better you picked up flu in breast than what they're having in New York now. In New York, there's an epidemic of infantile paralysis.
Well, thank heaven I'm too old for that. When I said goodbye at the dock, I remember telling them I'd be back on the next boat.
I'm afraid you won't be.
But I've got to. You see...
I may as well tell you, Mr. Roosevelt, when you leave the Leviathan in New York, you'll go on a stretcher.
But this flu, Doctor, I'll shake it off.
You had flu. Now it's double pneumonia.
By the time he had sufficiently recovered, the war was ending. He did not become an officer in the Navy. In the White House, Woodrow Wilson was making plans for his League of Nations, an ideal for which he fought up to the point where he could fight no more. But when the Democratic Convention of 1920 nominated James M. Cox for president and Franklin D. Roosevelt for vice president, the fading Woodrow Wilson begged them to carry on the fight for the League. They knew it might mean the end of their chances, but they could not refuse. In the election that followed, they were defeated. Mid-August, 1921. On a brief trip to his summer home at Campobello Island, Roosevelt was slightly chilled. With his children, he went for a two-mile run. Feeling better, he went for a swim in the icy open water of Fundy Bay. Back at the house, the mail was waiting. He sat in his wet bathing suit reading it until he felt chilled again. The next morning, he had symptoms of a cold, peculiar feelings in his legs. The second morning...
I can't move. My legs. Why, I can't move them. Something's wrong.
Anna! James! Say, doesn't anybody ever get up in this house?
It's Louis Howe, Franklin.
Yes, I knew it was Louis. I didn't even have to turn over and look.
Well, how are you feeling? Better, I can tell that already.
Fine, fine. We've sent for specialists. I've had a pretty full career for any man, Louis. Thank God it got me instead of the children. Mother wants me to come to Hyde Park. Stay there until, well, the rest of my days.
And what have you decided?
I've decided to live the rest of my life as if this illness had never happened.
Good. Good. I can help you do it.
We can help him do it, Louis.
I can look after business matters for you, see people that you wouldn't be able to see.
I can attend political meetings for you, keep you posted on what's going on.
But, Eleanor, you've never been mixed up much in politics.
Perhaps I don't know much now, but I will. I'll learn.
Then it's settled.
It's settled, Franklin. The three of us will work together.
For three tedious years, there was no improvement. Yet Franklin Roosevelt carried on his normal life, never once admitting that he could not walk. There had been a very slight improvement by 1924, and on crutches, he placed Al Smith in nomination for the presidency from the floor of Madison Square Garden. During the campaign, he worked 14 and 16 hours a day. Then he heard about Warm Springs, Georgia. The warm waters of the springs helped him, and he wanted to share its benefits with others less fortunate. Unknown even to some members of his family, he risked his private fortune in its development. Today, he considers it a major portion of his life's work. Roosevelt, yes. They wouldn't leave him in Warm Springs. In 1928, the people of his native state demanded that he come back home. We want Roosevelt, and they got him. He became governor of New York in 1928. And if his family were disturbed by his re-entrance into public life and the awful strain it threatened to place upon him, they still had cause for satisfaction. For just 2 days before his nomination, Franklin Roosevelt had taken his first steps without aid of any kind. Franklin Delano Roosevelt has two characteristics that have often been noted. He has that hard-to-describe intangible called color, a flair for the dramatic. And he has the happy faculty of being able to put his thoughts into phrases that are easily remembered, into phrases that touch the hearts of millions. When he was nominated at Chicago in 1932, Roosevelt made a dramatic flight from New York to make his acceptance speech in person. The years ahead were to witness other dramatic journeys, to Mid-Atlantic for the historic charter meeting, to Casablanca, to Tehran, to Quebec. And the years ahead were to be marked by Roosevelt-spoken words that would etch themselves into men's souls. One of the most significant, one of the most prophetic of his utterances was this.
There is a mysterious cycle in human events. To some generations, much is given. Of other generations, much is expected. This generation of Americans as a rendezvous with destiny.
Yes, prophetic words indeed. For on a December day in 1941, this generation of Americans was forced to keep that awful rendezvous. Before that December Sunday, Americans had been divided. Then came the deed of treachery, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt welded national unity with truth.
We are now in this war. We are all in it, all the way. Every single man, woman, and child is a partner in the most tremendous undertaking of our American history.
Clashing opinion was dissolved by the common peril, and 136 million people spoke their minds. Their spokesman was their commander-in-chief.
No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people, in their righteous might, will win through to absolute victory. I believe that I interpret the will of the Congress and of the people when I assert that we will not only defend ourselves to the uttermost, but will make it very certain that this form of treachery shall never again endanger us. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph. So help us God.
Thank you, William Adams, for your fine performance, your fine impersonation of our president. And now, Frank Sinatra.
Thank you very much for that applause. Maybe I'd feel that I really deserve it if I could make you all go out and buy at least one extra war bond. But I'm not much of a salesman, and I'm going to show you how I can prove it. See, I've done an awful lot of jobs in my life trying to make a living. And like many other kids, I once tried to sell magazines from door to door. I guess I wasn't much good at it. And the guy in charge of us used to say, look, Shorty, you got to give them the old high pressure. You can't expect them to buy things unless you high pressure them into it. Perhaps that was good advice, but the truth is that I've never been able to high pressure anybody into doing anything. So don't expect any fancy speeches from me. All I can do is to tell you what I feel in my heart, and that is that nobody could find a better investment in the world today in United States war bonds. Nobody could find a safer investment. We all know the figures involved. In 10 years, you get $100 back for every 75 you invest. And that return, as we say in Jersey, ain't hay. But I don't believe that there are many Americans today who are buying war bonds just to make money on the deal. Not by a long shot. For somewhere today, a boy you know is maybe on a train, or on a ship, or marching through mud towards a fighting front. His gun and his food and the care he receives are all bought through you by buying your war bonds. Whether or not he comes back healthy and sound, whether he comes back at all, depends on what those of us who are safe here at home do in the sixth war loan drive. Finally, I can say to you is go out and buy those war bonds. Buy every one you can afford, and remember when you do, that's your way of applauding the greatest performers America has ever had, the boys and girls in our armed services. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank Sinatra. These Are Our Men, featuring today the dramatization of President Roosevelt's life story, and with Frank Sinatra as today's special guest, is presented each Saturday by the Parker Watch Company, but not to sell Parker watches. Our aim is to remind as many millions of Americans as we can reach that certain as we are in our ultimate victory, it can be too long delayed unless every one of us carries his share of the burden. Saturday, the Parker Watch Company will present the intensely interesting life story dramatization of General George C. Marshall, Army Chief of Staff. And as our guest, we will have Francho Tone. So for the sake of an entertaining and educational half hour, listen in next Saturday to These Are Our Men. And for the sake of our servicemen, buy at least one extra $100 bond between now and then. We're happy to announce that the Parker Watch Company is making these scripts available to all educational institutions throughout the country. This program featured the distinguished American actor William Adams, who impersonated President Roosevelt, and Stotz Cotsworth, who was our narrator. Music was composed and conducted by Joseph Chernyovsky, and the entire production was under the direction of Anton M. Leder. Are Our Men is being recorded by the Office of War Information for shortwave rebroadcast to foreign countries. This is Jack Costello speaking.
These Are Our Men, on Tuned to Yesterday from December 2nd, 1944, a syndicated recording. You are listening to an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Livonier. In 1940, President Roosevelt commanded some of the nation's naval fleet to position themselves at the Pearl Harbor Station in Hawaii as a way of deterring Japanese forces from invading our coast. At the time, conflict was rife in Europe with the rise of Adolf Hitler, and many countries were choosing sides in the Second World War. By November of 1941, it was clear that Japan was part of the enemy or Axis forces, and any peace negotiations were becoming impossible. And the U.S., to that end, stopped any trade with the country. The aggression of a desperate Japan became evident on the morning of December 7, 1941, when Japanese warplanes launched a sneak attack on the Pearl Harbor Naval Base, destroying 5 of 8 battleships stationed there and killing nearly 2,500 servicemen. After this unprecedented and tragic attack, the United States officially became part of the Second World War, with the entire country banding together by way of volunteering for military duty or other home front sacrifice to battle the Axis powers of Japan, Italy, and Germany. With the same speed as the attack itself, the news of it was broadcast on radio to all stations with an urgency that was rarely, if ever, heard on the air.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air, President Roosevelt has just announced. The attack also was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu.
Here is what has happened. President Roosevelt phoned Secretary Early half an hour ago that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor, the United States naval base on Oahu Island in the Hawaiian Islands. This means that war is underway between Japan and the United States.
Normal radio programming was interrupted, and the news was even integrated into many of the shows on air that day.
Keep tuned into the station for latest reports from the invasion front. The following program, the Dinah Shore program, will be interrupted by the CBS newsroom to bring you any important news flashes that come in during the next half hour.
Here's director Cecil B. DeMille on the Lux Radio Theater on the evening of December 7th, 1941.
And now, a brief but serious word. It is war. War to the end. Japan has asked for it, and America is answering in the strongest language the world has ever heard. Every city must back the men in the armed forces. Back them with work and with money. Buy United States defense bonds and stamps. Get them at your post office or savings and loan association. Get defense stamps at your retail store or from your newspaper carrier boy. Buy them as often as you can, and guarantee the destruction of the Japanese Empire.
Even in the days after America's entrance into the Second World War, radio itself had formed a different tone. One of the best and most memorable examples of this was the change of the signature opening of radio's Texaco Star Theater.
It's Texaco time. This program will be interrupted for any important news flashes. And now, Larry Elliott. This is the first Texaco Star Theater broadcast ever to go on the air without its distinguishing air signature, the sound of the siren and bell. This change has been made because the siren has now become a signal of alarm and danger throughout our nation. So to avoid any possibility of confusion or disturbance to our listening audience, the sound of the siren and bell will be missing from the Texaco Star Theater until further notice. Yes, within the last 2 days, America has seen great changes. The shock of being at war has made itself felt in the heart of every American and has influenced the thinking of every citizen. Tonight on the air, we hope that our Fred Allen show, going on as usual, will provide our audience with helpful diversion. For civilian morale is important when the first task of every American is to help make America strong. To this task, we dedicate our manpower, our machines, our industries. In this respect, the Texas Company is proud to report that the strength of our vital oil industry is by far the greatest in the world.
Next in sound is a montage produced by the CBS Radio Network in the middle 1940s, which brings us the announcements of that day, even the landmark address by President FDR.
Where were you on the afternoon of December 7, 1941? If your name is Michel Piastro, you were at Carnegie Hall tightening the strings of your violin for the Sunday afternoon performance. If you are Gerald Nye, you are addressing 2,200 America Firsters in Pittsburgh. If your name is Saburo Kurusu, you are waiting in the outer office of Cordell Hull. If you are a sailor named Tomish at a place called Pearl Harbor, you and 2,116 of your buddies will be dead when the day is done.
We
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin.
The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air, President Roosevelt has just announced. The attack also was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu.
Still going, he's up to the 25, and now he's hit and hit hard about the 27-yard line. Bruiser Kennard made the tackle.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
I want to warn the people of this city that we are in an extreme crisis. Anyone familiar with world conditions will know that the Nazi government is masterminding Japanese policy, and the action taken by the Japanese government this afternoon. It was carrying out the now known Nazi technique of murder by surprise. So there is no doubt that the thugs and gangsters now controlling the Nazi government are responsible and have guided the Japanese government in the attack on American territory and the attack on the Philippine Islands. Therefore, I want to warn the people of this city and on the Atlantic coast that we must not and cannot feel secure or assured because we are on the Atlantic coast and the activities this afternoon have taken place in the Pacific. We must be prepared for anything at any time. As mayor of the city of New York and on my own responsibility, I have ordered all Japanese subjects to remain in their homes until their status is determined by our federal government. The offices of the Japanese Consulate General are now being protected by the police department until the status of the Japanese Consul General is determined by our federal government. He will be protected and escorted to and from his office. I have ordered, on my own responsibility, a Japanese club in this city to be closed, in keeping with my order that all Japanese subjects must remain in their homes until their status is determined and further orders issued. As mayor, I have been in communication and in touch with all the necessary federal agencies in this city. There is full and complete cooperation. I have reported the action taken by the city government to the governor of our state. I have been in communication and in touch with the authorities in Washington. I now want to appeal to the people of our city to be calm. There is no need of being excited or unduly alarmed. But I want to repeat what I said before, that we are not out of the danger zone by any means. And to be prepared to receive instructions and to cooperate at any time that instructions are given to the citizens of this city, and to cooperate with any plan that may be announced for their protection and the protection of their homes. As United States Director of Civilian Defense, I am communicating with all regional officers, instructing them to communicate with the governors of the states within their regions, and asking the governors, state and local councils, to intensify the training of air raid wardens and auxiliary fire forces. More detailed instructions to the regional directors will follow. To all air raid wardens and auxiliary firemen now enrolled, I'm asking them to prepare to attend daily drills. It is necessary that we be on the alert at all times. My friends, we must toughen up. We have our homes and our lands to defend now. We must remain cool and yet determined. We are aware of the danger ahead, but unafraid. In the meantime, know that your city government is on the job and looking after your welfare and comfort and safety. Tomorrow, in all likelihood, we will know exactly where we stand when we hear from Washington. We can all rest assured that our national government will take the necessary steps to protect our land and our institutions. And we can also be certain that our great president at this very moment is taking just those necessary protective steps. So in the meantime, good night, and we will remain on the job.
The President of the United States.
If your name is Sam Rayburn, you lift your gavel and rap for order. As a joint session of senators and representatives, many of them bitter foes of the man on the rostrum, cheer him madly. Because like most Americans, they are angry, frightened, and confused. And he is the President of the United States.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate, of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation. And at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. Indeed, 1 hour after, Japanese air squadrons had commenced bombing in the American island of Oahu, the Japanese ambassador to the United States and his colleague delivered to our Secretary of State a formal reply to a recent American message. And while this reply stated that it seemed useless to continue the existing diplomatic negotiations, it contained no threat or hint of war or of armed attack. It will be recorded that the distance of Hawaii from Japan makes it obvious that the attack was deliberately planned many days or even weeks ago. During the intervening time, the Japanese government has deliberately sought to deceive the United States by false statements and expressions of hope for continued peace. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. I regret to tell you that very many American lives have been lost. In addition, American ships have been reported torpedoed on the high seas between San Francisco and Honolulu. Yesterday, the Japanese government also launched an attack against Malaya. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Hong Kong. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Guam. Last night, Japanese forces attacked the Philippine Islands. Last night, the Japanese attacked Wake Island. And this morning, the Japanese attacked Midway Island. Japan has therefore undertaken a surprise offensive extending throughout the Pacific area. The facts of yesterday and today speak for themselves. The people of the United States have already formed their opinions and well understand the implications to the very life and safety of our nation. As Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, I have directed that all measures be taken for our defense, but always will our whole nation remember the character of the onslaught against us. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory. That I interpret the will of the Congress and of the people when I assert that we will not only defend ourselves to the uttermost, but will make it very certain that this form of treachery shall never again endanger us. Hostilities exist. There is no blinking at the fact that our people, our territory, and our interests are in grave danger. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph. So help us God. I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
From the CBS Radio Network, a montage of Pearl Harbor coverage, announcements, and addresses that were broadcast on December 7th, 1941. And that wraps up this hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for listening.